So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, we've got a bit of fun news and more serious news. We're going to talk about the PlayStation 5 and The Last of Us, and also diving into some major changes happening in the world of facial recognition among some of the major technology companies. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review, especially if it's on iTunes. That's super helpful. And drop us a note at podcast@engadget.com. You can also leave us a quick note in our web form that's right in our show notes. So just look up our post on Engadget and you can find it right there. So to talk about the PlayStation 5 and a lot of video game news, we're chatting with Nate Ingram, Deputy Managing Editor of Engadget. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Pretty good, guys. How are you hanging in there this week?
Busy. I'm also in the middle of moving. Like, I am T-minus 1 week from the move, so everything's being boxed up furiously. It's all crazy. Sherlyn, any updates on your end?
I mean, I think we're all crying every day, just figuring all of this out. I had some time off this week, but I know you guys were slammed with, like, last week and this week. Like, gaming news seems to be very heavy.
Well, you know, E3 was supposed to be going on at the beginning of June, and they've kind of just stretched it all out to kind of go throughout the month, it feels like.
So it's remote E3 is what's happening. We're all just surviving that, which, hey, I would rather be in LA, but... In terms of like actually getting news out, it's all right.
I mean, they stretched out the week for you, so this like endless hell week has become like an endless hell month. It feels like
kind of right. So I think like EA Play is Thursday night at 7. We had PS5 earlier in the week. We had Xbox a couple weeks ago. Not gaming, but WWDC is virtual next week. So it kind of feels like normal again, which I like. Even if we're not there.
We're just doing it all from home instead of traveling and being in a cramped conference room or something trying to cover this. So let's talk about the PlayStation 5 stuff, because last week Sony had, you know, a big game debut event, but they saved the most interesting bit for the end. They finally revealed the console, and hey, that's a big boy. That is a big, curvy console with big tails. I see a lot of people memeing it, and I guess that's what happens when you see something new, because it looks like a weird giant piece of modern art. But I kind of like the fact that it looks a little different, even though it's very large, and I'm not sure how well it's going to work horizontally. I'm fine with it, and there are going to be two different models. The main one, which has a 4K Blu-ray drive, finally. It is shocking.
Finally.
Shocking to me that 4K Blu-ray, a format that Sony co-founded, was not supported in the PlayStation 4. Meanwhile, the Xbox One S and Xbox One X did it, you know, years and years ago, 5 years.
But Devendra, you have to recognize this is a hill that you and very few others want to die on.
Listen, it just doesn't make any sense. Why is Microsoft supporting your format?
Nobody cares about it.
Are people really using 4K Blu-ray?
Well, no. Not really. Honestly, well, a lot of new movies, like if it's a major new release, it gets 4K Blu-ray. I feel like enough people are buying it, but nobody's buying it. They keep making them. Like, somebody's buying it for them to keep making this stuff. So anyway, I'm one of those weirdos. Me and my cinephile friends are. So these have the new drives, but there's also a digital edition which has no drive at all, and is hopefully, we don't have pricing for any of these, but hopefully that'll be cheaper. It looks a little sleeker. That is Sony going all in on digital downloads, which makes sense because then people can't buy used games, which don't earn Sony more money. So, it's a lot of stuff. Nate, any thoughts here?
So as far as the looks, I think it's funny how much people care about this. You said that was the most exciting news. I kind of disagree because, like, I don't really care what the console looks like. Like, sure, you want it to look nice on your shelf, but for the most part, like, does it have the games? But I'm more concerned with the, like you said, the size rather than the physical design. Yes. Like, it's a big boy. It might be kind of difficult to put in your space, which is, you know, not ideal. As far as going digital only for the models, I think you're right. That one could definitely be cheaper as a way for more people to get into it. If you don't buy discs anymore and don't watch movies on disc, then, you know, if it saves you $50, that might be worth it considering how much these consoles could cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't know. And I feel like both Microsoft and Sony are basically playing a game of chicken, because what we know from the hardware is that these things are basically going to be very powerful gaming PCs. I wrote a piece several months ago because these things are going to be running powerful processors, next generation AMD GPUs that can do ray tracing, all sorts of fun stuff. This is heavy duty hardware. They want to be able to play 4K beyond 60 FPS. They want to be able to support 120 FPS gaming, you know, maybe for 1080p. But to build a computer that does that today, that will cost you over $1,000 even before you include a monitor. So the way consoles typically work is that, you know, they get hardware that can be a little more powerful because they're not running a full version of Windows or something. And companies tend to take a small, they take a hit with some console hardware too. That was at least the way it worked back in the Super Nintendo and Genesis and PlayStation days. More recently, I've read that Microsoft took a hit with the Xbox One X because that hardware was so powerful too. It was much more powerful than the PS4 Pro. So the question is, what are we expecting to see here? $500 is kind of the assumed range, but looking at this hardware, I could see up to $600 for either of these machines, the full PS5 or the Xbox Series X, right, Nate?
I feel like that's got to be the limit, though, $500 personally. Yeah. Like, I agree that it could be $600, but I think that's what Sony did when it launched the PS3, and they got creamed for it.
They did get, and we're in the middle of a worldwide recession. Pandemic is still happening. People are out of work. Sony executives have made these comments that basically say gamers will appreciate, you know, the value of what we're giving them, or they want it to be something they aspire to. And that language really does make me think it's going to be more expensive than people think. I could see the full version of the PS5 being $600 and the digital version being $500. That would be nuts, but
I wouldn't buy at that price.
I mean, listen, you want to play the next Last of Us or the next other game? Yeah, you probably wouldn't buy it at the beginning. Maybe more consumer friendly, maybe $500 for the top end one, $400 for the all digital one, and then we'll see how Microsoft goes. Based on what we know from the hardware, the Microsoft hardware seems like it's slightly more powerful. The GPUs clocked higher, the CPUs clocked higher, and Microsoft is using slightly better RAM too. That's why the Xbox Series X looks like a giant PC, it looks like a PC tower. So it's a new era for consoles. They're basically gaming PCs. I'm going to be really interested to see kind of where these things go, but I really hope we don't go beyond $500. Any thoughts on the games Sony showed off, Nate? There's a new Spider-Man Miles Morales standalone game. It's not going to be a full size game like the last Spider-Man, but
it is.
Well, so here's the thing.
No, it's 100% going to be.
No. They're saying, this is what I'm saying. It's standalone in the way that Uncharted Lost Legacy was. That's what it sounds like. Like a $40 shorter game that you can buy on its own, because they're saying it is not as long a game.
There's been so much back and forth.
There is a lot of
I'm looking at the most recent thing that we heard was that all they've said is it's a standalone game. They haven't commented on the length at all. So I think
there was a lot of confusion, right? Based on one executive who said that it's sort of an add-on to the last Spider-Man game.
He totally misspoke.
But I mean, you look at the timeline here. That Spider-Man game is not that old. I don't think they had time to build a whole new engine, you know, build a whole new version of the city. I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up being a $40 thing similar to Lost Legacy, but yeah.
Did they give a timeline for when it was going to launch?
I don't think so.
Right. It could come in 2021 as a full title, possibly. But
I
think
hope that's a launch title. Yeah.
I think regardless of what it ends up, if it's going to be a slightly shorter or a full game, either way, it's going to be super interesting because the trailer looked amazing, if you ask me.
It looks cool.
Yeah, it looks cool. And I think people are just very excited to play Miles Morales.
Miles is cool. I like the bit I played of him in the last game, too. He has kind of a key role in the middle of the game.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're seeing a couple other cool exclusives, too. Horizon Forbidden West is the sequel to Horizon Zero Dawn. Sherlyn, I don't know what Sherlyn is doing over here. So,
I'm giggling because when we were preparing to talk about this on the podcast, I called this, and I had covered the Horizon Forbidden West games on our news shift. I was like, Horizon Fortnite West, right? It's just like my strange brain mashing up the games.
You're just gonna mash it all together. That game looks cool. I like the Last Horizon. I did not finish it. I know you're a big fan, Nate.
Yeah, that was
one. Excited.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite games of the last generation. If The Last of Us was my fave, that one comes in probably at number two or three at worst.
I think it's fair to call you basically a Sony first party fanboy.
I think you're
on board with those games, right?
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, the games that I love the most was Last of Us, God of War, Horizon Zero Dawn. Spider-Man was great. You know, no disrespect to the Microsoft side of things, but I just don't see the games there that make me really want to run out and buy an Xbox.
For sure.
I might be missing things for sure. But like every Sony event, there's at least one or two exclusives that get me really excited.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't blame you. Among other Sony exclusives, by the way, Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart, new version of that game. There's Stray, which I think it may be a timed exclusive, but that is a cool futuristic game. It looks post-apocalyptic, and you play a cat with a backpack, and I'm very excited for that.
Oh, good lord.
Super cool.
Super
cool. I'm surprised there haven't been more games where you play as a cat. Let's be honest, the internet loves
There's
cats.
A game where you play as a goose already. Come on.
Oh, and
there are
game.
Some. There's an indie game, a first-person indie game, where you play as a cat. I forget the name, but you play as a cat that jumps around and just wreaks havoc. So
that's great.
That's
sort
cool
of like
thing.
Untitled Goose, but for a cat.
Yep.
Basically. And Sony also showed off a couple things that are definitely coming to other platforms like Hitman 3 and Resident Evil 8. But there's certainly a brand power when you are the ones to kind of say, hey, we are revealing this game and this is maybe coming to us first. It seems like Sony once again has the games. Microsoft bought several studios. I know they're like building things up, but there's also stuff we don't know, like Halo Infinite. We don't know what that is. And I don't know how much people really care about Halo now compared to like a narrative thing like what Sony tends to build on. I will say I really like Game Pass, and I like the subscriptions and services Microsoft has built up, because Game Pass basically is a free flowing, you know, wheel of games that comes to me every month. There's games on my PC. There's games on my Xbox. There's a lot of stuff that I get for free, and games that I've been meaning to play and just never got around to just pop up, and I don't have to pay anything extra for them. So I think it's a genuinely great value. You also get like first party games immediately. You get them at launch for free, right?
Yeah. So as a Sony guy, I will say that I think that Microsoft takes care of its customers extremely well lately. Backwards compatibility, Game Pass, that stuff all sounds, you know, as somebody who is in the Sony system mostly, sounds great. Like PS Plus is okay. I have a great, huge library of stuff that I've gotten through that, to be honest. But it just sounds like Xbox's setup is a little more user-friendly, a little bit better thought out.
Yeah. I mean, Microsoft is all about the platform too, right? They don't, honestly, they're getting to the point where they don't care if you have the Xbox. What matters is that you are on Windows or you have something that runs their services, you know? Yep. And I could see even eventually, like, we've seen some Xbox integration move over to the Switch. I could see them, you know, doing some interesting things, maybe bring some Game Pass stuff there, maybe bring remote play, like portable play for your Xbox games, bring that to the Switch. That would all be really, really interesting. New console generations, it's an exciting time. I wish it was landing at maybe a better time for the planet, because there's so much else going on that thinking about consoles just feels superfluous. Speaking of games, by the way, Nate, you reviewed The Last of Us 2 for us.
I did.
Which is a game I know you've been looking forward to. I've been really looking forward to it. In your, you know, non-spoilery way, any initial thoughts?
I mean, it was massive in every meaning of the word. It took me about 25 hours to play it, which is more than 10, more than the original, I would say. Beyond that, the like scope of the environments you're in is huge. You know, there's a lot less gating in terms of keeping you to one section to the next. Like if you run into an encounter with a lot of enemies, you have to remember you can run to like a completely different part of the area. Like the span that you can move in is massive. So you can really like get away, restart. And I found myself having to remember to do that rather than saying like kind of stuck in the same little area, trying to get out of trouble. It's very difficult. I played it on the medium difficulty level, and then I tried it on hard, and hard kicked me around pretty good. And I know how those games work really well because I played the
first
one. And
you could change the difficulty on the fly too, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, so Naughty Dog did a ton of accessibility stuff with it, and this is just scratching the surface, but you can obviously change the difficulty on the fly, but you can also adjust difficulty for things like combat versus the availability of items in the world versus stealth. And so if you're like, oh man, I'm really enjoying the difficulty, but I don't have enough ammo, you can make it so there's a little more ammo, for example.
That's cool.
Yeah. Story-wise, the story is massive and branches and touches on tons of things. Like I said, we're not going to spoil it here, but it is super bleak and super dark, even more so than the first game.
Exactly what we need to play.
I know.
Right,
and I honestly...
What an escape.
I feel a little bit for Naughty Dog having to, you know, having to release the game right now. They were initially going to bring it out in February, and then it got delayed to May. And, you know, it's tough to sell a pandemic game in a pandemic world with, like, very little hope in it. But on the other hand, the people who love it, and that is a pretty large group of people, will play it no matter what. So, and then, you know, it'll be around for years. I'm sure they'll make it available on PS5. So even if this isn't the year to try it, in a year or two, you know, it'll find more people.
There's a lot of coverage about the game, too, in terms of, like, it's not just bleak. It is also, like, very violent, very insane, and in a way, like, almost obsessively so. Like, it seems like it's reveling in the violence, maybe even more than the first game. How did you feel about that? Because this is an Ellie-focused game. You know, you're playing as the girl you were trying to save in the first game, and I thought the whole idea was, in the first game, was try to, like, protect her from the world in a way, but it also seems like she's just become the monster that Joel was. Is that the point?
I think that you're touching on something that's pretty accurate. And again, without giving away the details, you know, the game starts and you see her, like, having a pretty, like, great life, relatively speaking, in the post-pandemic, in a community with lots of, you know, friends and relative safety and security. And then something happens that totally shakes her life up, and she goes on this journey for revenge.
She just can't catch a break. It sucks.
No, it does suck, and it sucks to see it because, you know, I came to care about that character quite a bit in the first game. I would say, yes, it sort of, like, keeps pushing her further and further into, like, being the bad guy to some degree. But at the same time, like, when I was playing her, because of what happened, I was wrapped up in that and, like, feeling her need for revenge also. And then there's, like, a perspective shift and, like, some plot stuff that happens that makes you kind of reconsider how righteous she may be. And it's really well done. Like, it starts, you know, it's a revenge tale. It's about cycles of violence, all stuff that's been done before. But I think in typical Naughty Dog fashion, they tell it in a really great way, and that the journey is worth going on. Yeah, it gives you a lot to think about. In terms of the actual violence, yes, it's super violent. I think that the difference between the first game and this one is mostly that with the PS4 being used to its full advantage, like, the fidelity of the up-close violence is more disturbing. It's not that it's necessarily a lot more frequent, but it does just, like, look more realistic. You know, you're... Yeah, so it's a lot.
I gotcha.
But if you play the first one and were, like, generally tolerant of how that game worked, this one shouldn't push you too far off that. I will say that for the review, I had to kind of binge play it, which I probably would have done anyway. But in retrospect, I think it'll benefit people to take some more time with it. You know, play for a while, put it down when you need a break, come back to it a few days later. Don't try and rush through it. Otherwise, like, you don't have as much time to think about the story, and you may also get a little overwhelmed with what's going on.
I'm looking forward to having my heart broken. I think the thing about that first game is that just that opening sequence where you play as a young girl and you see the pandemic start, and, like, it ends, you know, spoiler for a game that's basically 10 years old at this point, but, you know, the opening of that game, the character you're playing is a young girl who ends up dying.
Yeah.
Like, she is shot by the police because they're trying to contain this pandemic. And that is Joel's origin story, basically, of him, him having to deal with that. That is 15 minutes into the game. It is so powerful and so shocking. Like, that felt like a game-changing moment for games, just talking to people when that thing came out. So I'm hoping Last of Us 2 can give me some of that stuff. I am worried about the grimdark. I'm worried about games just focusing on on the darkest, bleakest possible things, because there are other ways to tell stories.
I don't think it's only that. I'll say that's like one of the biggest feelings of it, but it's not just like everything is terrible. It's there's a reason for what these people are doing that resonates with them, and it resonates with you as you're doing it. And there's also like some light found in they did a lot of flashbacks. They play with time a lot more in this game than they did in the first, which is fairly linear. And the flashbacks feel inspired by the Left Behind DLC. It's a lot of exploration, a lot of character building, and some of my favorite moments between both games come in those. Just absolutely beautiful stuff that the way it's framed, it hurts, but it's also really good to see.
Great.
Yeah, there's emotion all over the place. It took me a week before I could start writing the review because I just didn't know how I felt about it.
At least you had the time. Like, I can imagine rushing this game and then trying to get your thoughts out on it.
Yeah, so, no, I played it in about the span of a week, maybe a week and or 8 days, 9 days, and then I had a good week to write it up still.
Nice.
Yeah, it was good.
So go check out Nate's review of The Last of Us 2 on Engadget. It's worth a read, although I'm saving it for when I can actually play a bit of the game.
I support
I know
that.
You're not spoiling, like, I know you're not spoiling anything, but man, I'm just trying to be a little vigilant now, even though I can pretty much tell what's happening just from the murmurs from everybody. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I would love to live stream Sherlyn just playing the opening.
Oh, my God. The first one.
You've already spoiled it for me, though, so I'm not going to be surprised. I might be
but
heartbroken.
You have to see it to really...
Seeing it is one, like, is a whole other thing. Like,
do I have to get a PS4 for this or a 5?
I'll say I'll live stream it for you if you want to just watch Sherlyn.
You could just watch it on YouTube.
Oh gosh,
like, this is why people record.
I guess I'll be down. I don't know. So something you mentioned, Nate, just now about how, you know, this might not be the best title for people to buy now, and maybe in a few years it'll stay around. Do you think people will be nostalgic for the pandemic in a few years? Like, what?
No, I just think it'll be less of a present, you know, pressure. Like, you know, Dan Cooper wrote for our site. I guess right now is the best time to play the first game. He gave it a shot and was like, eh, I'm out. Another friend of mine did the same thing. She started playing and decided to save it for later.
It's a little heavy, but maybe someone can come back to it later when they're not saying nostalgic, but they've dealt with the stresses of
right,
real
exactly.
life right now.
Like right now, I think a lot of people want more disposable, easy stuff. And like, I have no judgment for that. It's absolutely a valid choice if you don't need to add, you know, it's like, do you want to watch Breaking Bad right now? I don't know, like maybe
or Overcooked too. You know what I mean? I'm just gonna keep shouting out Overcooked. Yeah, there's more fun games we heard about this week, right?
The cat game. Come on.
Oh, good.
The
Lord.
Cat game. I mean, the cat game is good. There are a couple things we could throw out here. Witcher 3 console players will be able to get a free copy of the game on PC, which I think is pretty cool. I mean, there's some really cool crossplay Witcher stuff happening. Like, if you've played the game on the PC and saved, like, backed up your save, you can continue on the Switch, which is astounding to me. Like, the fact that you can, that sort of stuff.
I would totally do that. I would totally do that.
You would also play that. Didn't you watch that show? Yeah.
I haven't touched anything Witcher myself. I haven't seen the show. I haven't played Witcher 3. It's 5 years old now. Do you think it's still worth a play?
It is. I think the Witcher 3, up till like 20 hours in, there's like one really good quest to do. I know people who love it. I can't stand the combat. To me, it feels like not really challenging or rewarding. Like, it just doesn't feel good as a combat game. But the story is good. The graphics are good. The world building is good. So I feel like you would love it, Nate.
I'll have to give it a shot then. Why not?
Yeah, there is now everybody can play The Witcher 3. And if you get it on console, you can get a PC version through the GOG store. So
that's cool.
That's pretty cool. I'm digging that. And also, there's a bunch of Pokemon news. Pokemon Snap 2.
Before you talk Pokemon,
finally coming.
Before you talk Pokemon, one quick thing about difficulty you mentioned. The Last of Us 2, I appreciate the fact they put in a story mode this time. So there's easy and then there's even easier. So like, no, if people want to just experience it the incredibly stressful gameplay, you can do that. So I like
that's
that.
Cool.
Lots of games are doing that these days.
Although I feel like that is why game streams exist too, for people to just sit back on YouTube and go through it all. Yeah.
No, a friend of mine who's been playing a lot of games during the pandemic is saying she just likes to you want to do it yourself still, not see
you
someone
do
else
it.
Do it. So
yeah.
Anyway, I think that it may be a generational thing too. Like, I grew up wanting to play the games and not just watching people play it. So
that is totally that's a very good point, actually.
Yeah. Kids these days, they can't even play their own games.
But they do love Pokemon still, if you want to pivot
back to
that.
They do love the Pokemon. Pokemon Snap 2, the sequel to the Nintendo 64 game, is finally coming to the Switch. That is exciting if you want to take photos of the Pokemon. I'm sure you will dig that, Sherlyn. There's also a Pokemon Cafe Mix game coming to iOS, Android, and Switch. Also, like, this is all for Sherlyn.
It's all for me.
And also, this final thing I think will also be for Sherlyn. There's Pokemon Smile, an AR phone game that will help kids learn to brush their teeth.
Why is this for me and not you and Sophia? Jeez.
I'm just saying.
Uh-huh. I mean, I might play it, like, don't get me wrong, but that cafe game, is that, like, can you explain it? It's like Diner Dash, but with Pokemon?
I can't. There's a trailer right now. I don't see much of gameplay. Yeah, I assume it'll be Diner Dashy or even, like, cooking Mama E. It sounds like you're managing a cafe.
Incredible. That is really, really up my alley. And yeah, I mean, it looks like, I mean, look, the graphics for the game has cute images of Pikachu, Eevee, and some of these newer Pokemons I don't care about. And like lots of delicious looking cake. Like, come on, man. This sounds like it's right up my alley. I don't want your pandemic game. I want this like Pokemon and cafe game.
It's a matter of time until we get the Pokemon pandemic game, and then things will really hit the fan.
Why did you have to ruin it, Devendra?
Sherlyn, you can only play Pokemon Cafe after you play The Last of Us on the hardest difficulty level. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the Pikachu revenge murder game.
That would be amazing.
Ash gets killed and Pikachu has to go rabbit, figure it out.
Rabbit Pikachu. It looks like Pokemon Cafe Mix is going to be free to download, which is nice, and then also will be out on June 24th, which, holy crap, I'm actually now looking forward
soon.
To
soon. And also, that's definitely going to be, like, you know, something with in-game purchases.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah,
for sure. Well, I am looking forward to the Pikachu murder game, and I'm sure you will too, Nate. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Nice to talk to you guys again.
Have a good one, man.
Later.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, enough of the fun stuff. Let's talk about something serious, and that is facial recognition. And I think in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests and you know, the widespread look at police reform and police culture in this country and how police tend to abuse their power, it turns out a lot of companies are thinking twice about how they're approaching facial recognition. And some big names, too, like Microsoft, says that it is now waiting for legislation, which we're kind of expecting in the next year, to occur before they start selling facial recognition tech again. Amazon, which has been selling its recognition technology, or recognition, I'm not quite sure how they pronounce
with
that.
With a K, yeah.
With a K, in a really cool, evil sci-fi way, yeah. That is a total RoboCop company move.
Jesus.
Recognition, yeah, because we are reconfiguring your brain. That's something they've been selling to police for a while. They're putting that on moratorium for a year, which is just a pause. They're not saying no more. IBM, meanwhile, is saying it's stopping work on general facial recognition technology altogether, citing human rights concerns. And that's interesting, because I feel like IBM always wants people to forget that they sold database technology to the Nazis.
I like how you never let them forget it.
No, I'm never going to let them forget it, because anybody, Volkswagen, cars of the Nazis, come on. You should remember your history. I don't know if that stuff will affect the way people use products today, but I think it's worth looking at companies and their cultures, and specifically tech. You know, we talk about how tech is ruining the world today. Hey, IBM has been doing it for almost 100 years. So, you know, that's worth noting. But yeah, they are backing out altogether. And probably because they don't have a huge business around that.
Right.
But I do find all this really remarkable. Just a lot of big changes happening really quickly. All of this, by the way, follows a new police reform bill by congressional Democrats, the Justice in Policing Act of 2020, which is mandating body cams and will require a court order for facial recognition. So it's going to be more like wiretapping, I guess. You know, a judge has to approve it, which, my God, I can't believe we didn't even have that restriction up until now. Any thoughts, Sherlyn? Because we've talked about facial recognition before. This is scary tech, especially around Clearview AI, this tiny startup which had somehow built up the most powerful facial recognition database anywhere, and police have already been using it. What are your thoughts?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that, like, didn't we already go through this with Clearview AI, which you just said? But then also, like, yeah, every big company and their grandmothers is working mm-hmm. on facial recognition tech because, A, I mean, apparently law enforcement wants it, but B, mm-hmm. like, they also use face recognition in a lot of their consumer-facing products, right?
Almost and, definitely, yeah.
Right. And so, like, this isn't new by any means. Like, the Microsoft and Amazon have been going back and forth with authorities on facial recognition regulation for a while. Like, Microsoft was calling for it, whereas Amazon was actually kind of just...
When
recognition was first, I think, sort of in the news around 2018, there were some protests around it. And it just struck me that it's been going on for so long, but it really took this, congressional Democrats putting forward this reform bill.
Well, it took nationwide protests. For this
right, it basically took the country to go on fire. Which for,
is, hey, you know, we,
better than
we,
nothing, I guess.
Yeah, it, that is how I think a lot of major change happens and major progressive change. So that is the value of protesting and being out on the streets. And shout out to everybody who is still protesting. Those things haven't stopped. People are still out there. Justice for Breonna Taylor. All of that, you know, we are still in the middle of a crazy amount of cultural rethinking in terms of how we think about law enforcement. So, yeah, it's a good time to look at facial recognition, too. Yeah, these companies, they're building this tech. There's a lot of it within our devices, but there's also a difference between like computer vision and, you know, just recognizing your face, just like your face unlocking your device or something. That's all happening locally. Apple, for example, uses Face ID in a way that is not, it's encrypted and it's not stored. Yeah.
Yes. I think that there is some of it that happens locally for device security. I was referring more to like Facebook's been identifying faces in your picture for
I know.
To tag your friends forever.
Yeah. Let me delineate between these because when it comes to recognizing faces for computing logins or even something like Google Photos, which you can allow it to recognize the faces of your family, that's all stuff happening that's kind of private to you. But yeah, Facebook's whole thing, right, is knowing who people are, trying to recognize people, trying to tie ads to specific people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not great. These companies want this stuff to succeed because they want that Minority Report future, you know, where for some reason that movie, they were scanning irises. Isn't it much easier just to scan faces, which are... easier to recognize and everything. But anyway, that is the future. Personalized ads, things like that. I think it's a really interesting step we're in. Clearview, by the way, after all that controversy, they announced that they would stop selling their technology to private companies. But yeah, still happening for law enforcement. This stuff is going to continue. This is just the beginning.
I think this bill is a good first step. I do think that after all, like our episode on Clearview AI, there's been so much news of like abuse of the Clearview AI system by people who have access to it or people and frequently people in power. And imagine if like there's, I don't know. I mean, I worry. I want the regulation to be enforceable as well. So like, you know, if it's something like requiring like a wiretapping style where you require not a warrant or a permission or a court order before you can run a facial recognition thing, then it has to be like, there has to be like restrictions around who can access it before like allowing it. So like, I don't know. I mean, my brain's going into full Law and Order SVU mode now. And it's like, you know, I can see this being abused already. And it's definitely very scary.
If you give humans, you know, extremely powerful technology, we will use it in upsetting ways.
Because we're flawed.
That's what we do. I'm hoping we can come up. We definitely need more tech-savvy politicians and people in power to also kind of think about and manage this technology. So here's hoping we come up with some good solutions over the next year. We'll definitely be following this closely.
There was some other fun, I guess, news this week. Twitter announced a new format. It's something called voice tweets that is testing.
A new old format, by the way.
Kind of old school, but it's new for Twitter anyway.
Twitter started out as Odeo, as a podcast company. So
they're
going full circle now because it's audio back into your tweets.
Yeah, see, I'm not old enough to remember Odeo. Anyway, Anyhow, your timeline might look very different. You will soon be able to post 140-second clips of some kind of audio. Whether it's you saying something or singing something, which is how I plan to use
this. They're really stretching the 140, you know, number thing. Like, yeah. It doesn't signify anything for audio, but okay. Yeah. Okay.
The whole reason Twitter is doing this, they say it's to introduce a so-called, in quote, more human touch to the timeline, which I get it. I think we have covered in the past that social media is where all discourse seems to be happening these days, and words can be so easily misread, misinterpreted. I don't know that voice is necessarily the way forward and the way to go, but I just think it's a change, and it's an interesting change, or full circle, as Devendra puts it. What do you think?
I think they're just, they don't have any way to add audio to tweets right now. That is the thing. So like when we actually break out clips of the show with our tool called Headliner, we actually create a small video file, which is played underneath our tweets. And that is a weird clunky thing. So yeah, just having, it's not just voice, it's any audio. It's the ability to throw any audio into your tweets. Hey, we're making a podcast now. Audio all of a sudden is a bigger thing, so it makes complete sense. I would use this more for like voice clips or something, or like a clip from the show, more than just a quick thought from, you know, from my tweets or something. So but it makes sense.
For me, I mean, I agree with you. I think that I still think that video is an important component to not forget. Now, with these voice tweets, you can include text with it. I believe also picture, but I'm not sure video. And it doesn't seem clear yet also whether you can upload an existing clip or whether you have to record live as you're, you know, posting
some
your
people tweet, have so. It I've seen these tweets already floating around. I just don't have it yet on my phone.
Neither. But when I do, you can be sure my Twitter might get more interesting, I guess.
I will say, first of all, my mute button is going to come in real handy once Roland gets this power. In other news, I cover this really interesting thing that Logitech is doing. They're bringing carbon impact labeling to all of their products, and it's going to show up as like a little C on the box with a number, and that basically is going to designate the carbon cost of a mouse or a keyboard from production through its entire lifespan. So even including its death and like when you will eventually get rid of it, this is a really cool thing. Nobody has ever done this before, and it's a really interesting way to make visible the environmental cost of our gadgets. It's something these companies talk about. A lot of companies say they're trying to, you know, go renewable or offsetting their carbon costs somehow. Logitech is actually going to show it to you right on the box, and they also want to make this an open platform, and I think that's pretty cool. So they want it to be something that other companies use, and you know, maybe when you're choosing your next mouse, you can look at like maybe one has a much higher carbon cost for some reason, you'll go for the lesser one. It reminds me a little of Energy Star ratings on appliances. The Logitech CEO says it's more like nutritional information. It's sort of like when you look at calories. Yeah. You know, before you eat something, you're like, do I want to put this in my body? Now the idea is when you buy a mouse, you'd be like, do I want to, you know, hurt the world in this way just to have a fancy new mouse? I think bringing that stuff to light is really interesting. And
I do think that it's a bold move on their part, if only because if it forces them to commit to like making things that are less carbon intensive, or you know, the carbon footprint isn't as high, because if someone sees on a Logitech product a bigger carbon cost, then they might not buy it, and you might be pushing people away from buying your own product.
They're
which is why a lot of companies haven't done this. They are putting themselves on the line. Because other companies I've covered, like HP, have committed to doing things like, oh yeah, we use like 90% like recovered plastics from oceans.
Just believe us, man. Yeah,
and that's very different from, and I mean, I admire that, but that's very different from slapping a label on your own product and saying, hey, this thing actually isn't that great for the environment. If you want to buy it, maybe consider our less carbon costly model, you know? I think that's...
Yeah. These ratings are also validated by several third parties. So it's not like just audited. Logitech, putting their own number in things. Like, they're doing a really interesting thing. I like Logitech as a company just because they're kind of, to think of like the pop star Never Stop Stopping song, they're so humble. They're a humble little company. I interviewed Bracken Darrell, the CEO from... Have you seen that movie, Shalyn? It's amazing. It's perfect.
What movie? Never Pop Stop Star. Stopping?
Yeah.
No.
It is perfect. No. You will love it. You will not stop quoting that movie if you see it. But anyway, I interviewed Bracken Darrell, the CEO, several years ago, and he just came across as like a really interesting, humble guy. This isn't the company that tends to shout about its accomplishments. They've only recently started producing commercials. I don't know if you watch things on cable TV or Sling TV or something. I'm seeing these cool Logitech lifestyle commercials now. They're kind of Apple-esque, just to remind people, hey, they make
We're
everything.
Here.
Yeah, so that's like the first thing they've done in a very long time. So anyway, I'm really digging Logitech as a company, and I think this initiative is really cool. They plan to add it to all of their products within 5 years, and they're going to start with some gaming devices later this year. I hope other companies follow suit. Yeah,
I agree. Would it turn you off of buying a product if you saw a high carbon nutritional label on it, or would you not care? Also, if you have any thoughts on what your first voice tweet might be, make sure to send them our way. Give us some ideas for what my or DaVinci's first voice tweets should be. Send your scripts to podcast@engadget.com.
Let's move on to our Engadget picks of the week. These are our pop culture picks to kind of refresh us and take us away from tech news a little. And I want to throw a shout out to Normal People on Hulu. And this is a series mostly directed and created by Lenny Abramson, but it's based on the Sally Rooney novel. It's about these two. It's a weird setup. It's just, it's two sad Irish kids. It's two sad Irish kids who kind of are in love, but they're so emotionally broken they don't know how to make it work.
Sounds very familiar.
I'm not gonna pry too much there. It is it's a romance story, but it's also like a story about modern love and just connection. And I think it's really interesting, and I think you'd appreciate it, Trillin, because the performances are just astounding. The two leads, Marianne and Connell, played by Daisy Edgar Jones and Paul Mescal, I've never seen these actors before, but these performances are astounding. They're so raw, so naked in many ways. And yes, this is a very sexy time show, so they will be naked quite a bit. But it's what they reveal in their performances, I think, are really fascinating. And they're both very different characters. Connell is this sort of like, he starts off as this jockey dude who may be a little more introspective and maybe smarter than some of his friends, but he doesn't know how to branch out of the social designation of being the semi-popular jock. And Marianne is this girl who is very smart and rich, but also socially isolated, and every single person hates her, including her family. So they form this connection. It's really interesting to see their relationship go up and down. And what I find fascinating, too, is that it is so realistic in many ways of how, you know, a simple communication breakdown can lead to a breakup for a year. That just feels so, it's if you guys just talk to each other, just say what you mean.
But they're kids.
They're not, I mean, this is like by the time they're in college. But yeah, you're still young. You still don't know how to manage all these feelings and emotions. I find it really fascinating. Worth a watch. Do not watch it with your parents. I feel like I have to throw that designation out there sometimes. But it's a really good show that'll break your heart. If you like the Before Sunrise and Sunset series of movies, which are among my favorites, you'll love this. It is just as heartbreaking, not as hopeful. I'd say it's not as light and airy as those movies can be, but it is worth watching. It's a fantastic series. So what have you been watching, Sherlyn?
I've been, so I spent this past weekend trying to catch up on a bunch of shows. I saw Artemis Fowl on Disney Plus, which was not good.
It
was not good. I'll just say, I'll put it out there. I was very frustrated the whole time. Didn't think that the protagonist was anywhere near bad enough.
I'm very glad we don't have to shout about this. So good.
Yes,
good.
Yes. I'm very glad you're not shouting at me about this. We fully agree. We're in agreement here. That was not a good movie. Then I also tried to watch Homecoming, and this is where we disagree. I think that you really liked Homecoming. You've recommended it on this show. I love Janelle Monáe's performance. I love Hong Chau's performance.
See the first season, or did you start?
That's,
with the
I think
second?
That's the biggest problem. Second season. Okay.
What?
Okay.
Sherlyn, you know one comes before two, right?
Well, yeah, but I don't feel like you did say I needed to watch the first season.
I did say.
Okay, so
it's
what
a
I'm gonna do then
of season one.
I'll watch the first season. It probably will be, it will make more sense, but watching it just the second season first.
Dear listeners, do not just start in the middle, just like you wouldn't open up a book.
Well, it seems like a standalone season.
No, it's not a standalone season. It's not a standalone season. It is, but yeah, you will not understand half of what's going on in Homecoming. Like, yeah, you
don't
know anything.
Right, and that's probably why it was so frustrating,
about the world. Although, honestly, would probably be kind of an interesting way to watch that season.
I'm telling you, I didn't get it.
Yeah, I would not. Yeah. Watch season one like a normal human being, Sherlyn.
Wow, are you calling me not normal? Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also a
much better season than season two. So season one is good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and finally, I do want to recommend a book called Black Fortunes by my friend, former classmate, Sho Wills. It's a book about the first black millionaires in America.
Oh, cool. Is that their full name, Sho Wills?
Shomari Wills is his full name. We all know him as Sho.
If listeners want to find the book, Sherlyn, come on, help your friend out over here.
Shomari, I've shared it, and he's first of all a great guy, like one of the first Big Brother figures, kind of like Devendra if Devendra wasn't mean.
Ugh.
And he's really, really kind and gentle. I love him. I love being like, you know, in class with him. Anyway, his book is great. I just started reading it, and it's very eye-opening. I mean, Sho kind of goes into a bit of his family history in the introduction, and then he opens with the first black millionaire ever, who I don't know if you guys might know this name. Maybe you don't because it's been mm-hmm. buried in history, but William Leesdorf. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing the last name mm-hmm. right because it's a mouthful. You know, it then goes on to explore some of these other names you might not have known about otherwise, including Mary Ellen Pleasant. Frederick Douglass is mentioned in the first chapter as well. But it goes on to cover a lot of these things in a very human way. And there's also, surprisingly, some twists and turns, which is weird. And one of the chapters is also going to cover what sparked the Tulsa race riots. So there's just a lot to learn about, and I think that this book was like released 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know, back
it,
then
it is interesting to see racial justice movies and books about the black experience in America becoming so popular now. Like, everyone's doing their homework, so
finally, right? Like me,
everybody
doing
that.
I'm finally
doing
my homework too. When Sho was doing his like book promotion stuff 2 or 3 years ago, I was like, this is really good, I really want to get it and read it, but then I never got around to doing it. And finally, like
Sherlyn's
everyone
such
else
a
in
good
the world,
friend, she waited 3 years.
I'm a very bad
friend,
I know. And when I finally shared his thing on my Instagram, Sho was like, thank you. I was like, I should have done this sooner.
He's like, yes, because first run sales matter the most.
Yeah, I don't know.
Wow.
I mean, it's got a 5-star rating on Amazon, you know.
Okay,
so that's
good.
Where I bought it.
I will
it.
Check this out. I think it sounds really cool. And by the way, speaking of like great black art, shout out to The Five Bloods on Netflix, Spike Lee's latest film.
Ooh.
It's incredible. I love to see like a master filmmaker in his craft making good movies again.
Yeah.
He's made some not so great low budget things. And between this and BlacKkKlansman, like, man, it is really great to have his voice out here now.
And that's our episode this week, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and I podcast about movies and TV at the /filmcast@slashfilm.com.
If you're not going to yell at me for not watching Homecoming Season 1 first, I'm at Sherlyn Low on Twitter.
Please
email
yell
us.
At her.
No, do not. You can yell at Devendra. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, please. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Or left
Nothing.
Twix and right Twix, yeah.
Nothing.
You
can know when Sherlyn's hungry.
Oh, you mean always?